Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Denko A session. A tradition we've been carrying on here for maybe 7 years or so. An annual session. Gathering the mind, gathering the heart in present suchness is Sesshin. And Denko A is the transmission of light assembly. Transmission of light, celebrating the awakening stories of the Zen ancestors of our lineage as recorded and commented on by Keizan Zenji in the 14th century. I'm not sure that everyone knows, so maybe I'll just mention that our Zen lineage sprouts forth from this stream of Dharma that founded in Japan by Dogen Zenji and a few generations later Keizan Zenji. So they're considered like kind of two co-founders of our lineage in Japan. And Dogen's teaching is conveyed through the Shobo Genzo, the treasury of the true Dharma eye, a massive tome of exquisite Dharma understanding. And Keizan's teaching is mainly in this record of the transmission of light, the Denko Roku. So together this treasury of the true Dharma eye and the transmission of light record may be most important to texts of understanding in our lineage. And these days, more and more, we like to present Dharma in modern forms. So the class series of this practice period is based on a book by a contemporary Buddhist teacher. Of course, always based on the tradition, but contemporary presentation. So in the contemporary Dharma scene, I think it's important to once in a while, a couple times a year maybe, really like break out the old texts and celebrate them and bring forth these teachings, because Dogen and Keizan really are together, I think, convey the understanding of Zen practice in our lineage. And it's so beautiful the way they express it, and I think it's timeless also. Even though these stories and teachings come from ancient times. And this transmission of light record, the Denko Roku, was, I think, especially appropriate for Sesshin, because when you hear it and the commentaries confirm that these were Dharma talks during Sesshin and practice period in Keizan's temple in the 14th century. So it'll bring up an old koan story and comment on it to the assembly in the Sesshin. And I think maybe it was a whole practice period and he went through all these 53 different ancestors. Maybe it was every day. I don't know how often he did this, but occasionally he'll say, it's getting near the end of the practice period now and we gotta keep practicing and things like this. So, So the setting, as you listen to these words, the setting, I think, I imagine, is very similar to this setting. We're kind of reenacting it. And the issues are the same as the old days. You know, the world is different in many ways. Modern technology, modern issues, climate crisis. We have some new things to deal with, but really, I think actually not so different. This, you know, this Kamakura period in Japan was a time of great turmoil and warfare and starvation and social discrimination. These issues have always been with us, and in the midst of them, these Zen ancestors were practicing Zen, like we are today, feeling there's value in this. We need to get to the bottom of things to be the most benefit we can to all beings in a troubled world. Never apart from the world, and yet sometimes immersing ourselves in a quiet sanctuary so our heart can really open. So this Benkō Roku has a chapter for each of these 53 ancestors of our Zen lineage, starting with Shakyamuni Buddha and ending with Ko-un Ejo, the disciple of Dogen, and the Dharma grandfather of Keizan Zenji. So there's 28 Indian ancestors, and then there's a whole bunch of Chinese ancestors, and then a few Japanese ancestors in here, and then I like how we have the chance to chant the lineage of ancestors in the morning, particularly during this Denko Ei Sesshin. Sometimes it's maybe it seems kind of long and tedious to go through all those, just recite all those names. But that's what we're celebrating in this Sesshin, is this lineage. The names we'll hear today are names that we chant in the morning. And of course, after Keizan, the names continue up through Suzuki Roshi and Sobun Catherine Roshi down to this temple today. And today's story is about the ancestor Ashvaghosha, the 12th Indian ancestor. Most of these Indian names, we don't really know anything much about them. They're kind of names, but some of them are actually well known generally because they wrote something and it got left to us. So of course, Nagarjuna is one of our ancestors a couple generations later. We know quite a bit about his style of teaching and Vasubandhu. And Ashvaghosha, I would say, is probably the third most known Indian ancestor. He wrote this great poetic version of Buddha's life story called the Buddha Charita, the deeds of the Buddha. It's like in verse form, right? A beautiful poetic, long, like love poem to the Buddha. And that's what he's most known for. We have that in English these days, that long poem of Buddha's life. And other things Ashvaghosha wrote. Ashvaghosha means a horse cry. Ashva is horse, and Ghosha is like sound or call or cry. So these stories always start with a koan, you know, the case. And they're all about the particular circumstances of the awakening of one of the Zen ancestors. So Keizan will quote the story, and then he gives a Dharma talk commenting on it. So the story goes like this, and don't worry if you don't catch it all. This is kind of a longer one. Keizan will go over it in line by line in detail, and we will too. It goes something like this. The 12th ancestor was the venerable Ashvaghosha. In Japanese, in the mornings we say, Anabote Daiyosho. He asked the venerable Punyayashas, we say, Funayasha Daiyosho. Kind of bad transliteration of all those names that we chant of the Indian ancestors are like the Chinese and Japanese attempts at transliterating the Sanskrit names. So sometimes they come out funny. So 12th ancestor Ashvaghosha asked the 11th ancestor, Punyayashas, I wish to know the Buddha. What is Buddha? I want to know Buddha, the awakened. What is Buddha? And Punyayashas replied, you wish to know Buddha, but that which does not know is Buddha. You want to know Buddha, but that which does not know is Buddha. Ashvaghosha said, since Buddha is not knowing, how can I know that it is Buddha? And Punyayashas said, since you do not know Buddha, how can you know that it's not Buddha? Ashvaghosa said, it's like a saw. Or this is like a saw. One translation interprets it as, this conversation is like a saw. And Punyayashas said, actually, it's like wood. Or one translation said, it's like a saw, but it's also like wood. But it's like wood, but actually I ask you, what do you mean by saw? And Ashvaghosa said, you and I are lined up evenly. It says, in parentheses, like the teeth in a saw. Or another translation, I think, interprets this as like a two-person saw. Each at the end, one of those long wood-cutting saws where there's a person at each end. I think either way is okay. But we're lined up evenly. That's what I mean by saw. What do you, teacher, mean by wood? And Punyayashas said, you are cut through by me. And at that, Ashvaghosa was suddenly awakened. That's today's story. It's kind of a lot going on there. Then Keizan quotes a little about the circumstances of a little bit of history of Ashvaghosa's life. These stories were all, Keizan collected these from this big collection of Zen stories called Transmission of the Lamp. So they were already collected in this kind of order like this, and they have a little bit of, you know, history about the ancestor. The master, Ashvaghosa, was from Varanasi, and he had also had the name Superior Virtue. He was so named because he was superior in virtue. In all virtues, both mundane and supramundane virtues. He visited Venerable Punyayasha's, and the first thing he asked was, I wish to know the Buddha. What is Buddha? And Punyayasha replied, you wish to know the Buddha, but that which does not know is Buddha. And so on. So, sometimes they have a lot more details about their life, but then there are some more later in the story. But that's what, yeah. The history of this ancestor is like right now. Now Kazan starts giving his commentary. He says, the first thing one must seek in one's study is Buddha. So, all Buddhas of the past, present, and future, as well as generations of ancestral teachers, are referred to as people who study Buddha. If you don't study what Buddha is, you're called non-Buddhists, or those outside the way of Buddha. Therefore, there was no need to seek in sounds or try to understand through forms. And it was not enough to think of Buddha in terms of the 32 marks and the 80 minor marks. So I think this is a great point that the students of Buddha means awakening. The students of awakening, of wakefulness, of present, fresh suchness maybe us today. Our main job is to study Buddha, to study awakeness. And so then Kazan says, so we don't need to actually study sounds and forms. And it's not enough to think of Buddha in terms of the 32 marks and the 80 minor marks. And this is a part of the Indian story of Shakyamuni Buddha had these marks, these characteristics, like physical marks, 32 of them. And I'm afraid I can't remember all of them, but some of them include like long earlobes, like a little hair curl in the forehead from which beams of light sometimes radiate, a protuberance on top of the head, all the hairs curl to the right, and there's Dharma wheel marks on the palms of the hands and the soles of the feet. And I think really long arms and a really long tongue. That's a few of the 32 marks of Buddha. 32 marks of great beings in India. So I think this is just, you know, part of the very ancient Indian kind of cosmology of, just like we might have palm readers, maybe, or people who can like study some like physiognomy. Is that a word? Yeah. Physiognomy is like you study the physical like marks of people, maybe even babies, and then you can make a prediction of what they'll be like. I think it's that kind of a thing. And the 80 minor marks that go on and on, right? So Kazan's this part of the tradition. Kazan's saying, don't think that it's enough to think of Buddha in terms of these 32 marks and 80 minor marks, right? As Zen people, we kind of know this. That's not the Buddha that we're really into studying. Consequently, Ashvaghosha asked, I wish to know Buddha. What is Buddha? In saying you wish to know Buddha, but that which does not know is Buddha. Or you could translate it as he who does not know is Buddha. He or that which does not know points to Venerable Ashvaghosha himself, not to anyone else. So, Ashvaghosha asks, I want to know Buddha. What is Buddha? And his teacher, Puniyasha, said, you want to know Buddha, but that which doesn't know is Buddha. And Keizan says, that which does not know points to the asker of the question, Ashvaghosha himself, not anyone else. In other words, who is this? Or what is this one that doesn't know? It's you and I. I might ask, I want to know Buddha. And then here, that which doesn't know is Buddha. And I might wonder, start then looking for, now I want to know that which doesn't know. Where is that one that doesn't know? So Keizan's saying, actually, that which doesn't know is you. The one who wants to know Buddha. The one who wants to know Buddha is the one who actually doesn't know Buddha but wants to know Buddha. And is Buddha. Buddha that is not knowing. So I think at this point it's good to stop a moment and just talk about knowing for a bit, because the big issue in this story seems to be about knowing, and it might not be so clear, but I would propose that there are two kinds of knowing, and we could talk about this in different ways, but I think it's helpful to look at basically two kinds of knowing. And one is the usual way we think of knowing things, like I know that this is a book, and I know that that's Corrine, and I know Corrine over there, and Yara over there, and I know myself as this body over here. And I know this Zenno as this space. So that's it. There seems to be, in this kind of knowing, there's a knower and a known. And they seem to be basically separate. They might seem to be related. Like, we could even say they seem to almost depend on each other. Like, I can't really, Corrine can't be known by me without there being a me to know her. So there's the knower and the known seem to be kind of interdependent, but there's still two different things, a knower and a known. We could call that dualistic knowing. Dualistic means that there's two things, a knower and a known. The usual way we know information this way, we know even sensory, direct perception, we know in this way as something external or separate from the knower. This is all one kind of knowing. And you could also call it consciousness, vijnana. The word jna is the same in Sanskrit, jna, in prajna and vijnana and jnana. And so on, is the same root as the English word know, nya, or gnosis, or knowledge. I think it's a cool what do you call it? Indo-European what's that?
Coincidence.
But it's really, they come from the same root. So Sanskrit and European languages are definitely related. So it's not actually pure coincidence. And there's many words in Sanskrit. Like, I've heard the etymology of Buddha as awakened is related to the English word bud, like that, which is kind of an opening, awakening of a flower. So I think, and there's many, so it's, Sanskrit's a nice language to study because there are many connections. And I think this is one of the most beautiful and maybe important ones in Buddhism, because there's a lots of nya words. Interestingly, Buddhism is really into this issue of how we know things. Prajna, we usually translate as wisdom, but it's like complete knowing, I think. And vijnana is like divided knowing. We usually translate as consciousness. But the vi of vijnana is also the same Sanskrit root as the English word divide or division. So it works very, so vijnana is like divided knowing. It's very similar, yeah? Divided knowing. Vijnana. This is a good one to remember. And we usually translate that vijnana as consciousness, like one of the five skandhas. But it means divided into subject and object, or dualistic knowing. So this is one kind of knowing. Or consciousness. The other kind is undivided knowing. You take the vi out of the vijnana and it's just called jnana. Jnana means just undivided knowing or non-dual knowing. And this word jnana is often translated, sometimes it gets translated as wisdom or knowledge, I've seen, but I think those are misleading because they can sound like dualistic knowing. So I think knowing, if I was going to translate the Sanskrit jnana, I would call it knowing or awareness. And I've seen this in Sanskrit dictionaries, and as a common way of translating. When we're talking about awareness, as opposed to consciousness, I understand this as jnana as opposed to vijnana. Corinne probably knows the Tibetan word yeshe. Yeshe is the Tibetan for Sanskrit jnana. And sometimes I've seen that the Tibetans maybe get a little more flowery and they often translate it as primordial wisdom or wakefulness, non-dual awareness, actually, is yeshe. Yeah, yeshe sogyal is jnana sagara, I think, in Sanskrit. So, what, and we might say, well, what is this jnana, this undivided knowing? We know about the divided knowing, that's how we're basically perceiving all the time. The sense that there's a knower and a known, and that they're not exactly the same. They might be dependent on each other. Whereas if it's really truly undivided or non-dual knowing, there's actually no separation or distance between them. It's going beyond even saying that the knower and the known depend on each other. It's like they are one suchness in undivided knowing. And this is what is actually happening. We could say that's Buddha, that's wakefulness, is undivided knowing or awareness, where what seems to be the objects separate from the knowing, when we actually explore very carefully in a quiet, calm way, especially if we have a whole bunch of zazen periods, we have such an opportunity to explore what is the known in relation to the knowing of it. Both, thoughts and conceptual knowing of things, but particularly like even sensory known things. What is the sound that we hear right now? It seems like there's an ear faculty over here hearing a sound over there. That's called ear consciousness, ear vijnana, divided ear knowing. Right? So we can start to explore the sound. Where is the boundary between the knowing of the sound, the experiencing of the sound, and the sound itself? Really look for where the knowing of the sound meets the sound, and we can come to look for that place and not find a place where they meet, because the sound in our direct, pure experience every moment is not, cannot be found as something other than the knowing of it. I propose the sound we're hearing right now is actually the experiencing of something we're calling sound. It's an awareness of sound, it's a knowing of sound, but we can't really find some actual sound other than the knowing of it. Can you follow that? And this is something that's a wonderful and amazing recognition we can open to in Sashin or at any moment, that what we call sound when exploring it very deeply is not something other than the actual knowing of the sound, or the awareness of the sound, or the experiencing of the sound. And likewise with colors, with tastes, with bodily sensations. This, the vibration, the tingling vibration in my knees right now is not something other than the knowing of this tingling sensation in the knees. So this kind of knowing, one maybe can see now that if we open to how the object is nothing other than the knowing of it, therefore it's not something separate. Right? It's undivided. What we call the object is simply the knowing of it. There's only knowing, or knowing knows only knowing. And we can come to know that knowing knows only knowing. Yes?
So did you just parse out not one and not two?
We could say not one is the from this discussion we could say not one is the sense of a knower and a known, like consciousness, divided knowing. And it really does appear this way, that you're over there and I'm over here. We could say that's the appearance of not one. And then the undivided knowing is the reality of not two. Does that make sense? So from this discussion, I'd almost say like, well, the actual reality is this undivided knowing of not two. Not two is non-dual knowing. And but there's definitely the appearance of not one at the same time. At the same time, right? It seems to be that you're over there and I'm over here, so there's that vivid and clear appearance every moment of our life, pretty much, of not one, of you and me. And at the same time, almost like underneath that, we can see the reality of not two. So in this way of talking, it's kind of implying, it is not one, not two, but it's kind of saying the not two is a little bit more real than the not one. they're not exactly equally, what can we say? I mean, they're equally happening, they're equally valid, and yet, you know, we could talk, one, the not two is more like the reality, and the not one is more like the appearance. And the appearance and the reality are inseparable. So in that way, not one and not two are inseparable. You follow this? It might sound kind of wordy, but we're talking about our actual experience right now. Yeah. And I think the not one part we're already very familiar with. I'm over here and you're over there, and we even know that we're kind of dependent on each other. But the not two part is we have to sort of like slide underneath our not one kind of knowing, our divided consciousness, through this sliding. Just comes from actually just being really present and calm and what did Dogen say in the chant that we just did? We vow with all beings, oh, from this life on, throughout countless lives, to hear the true Dharma, that upon hearing it, no doubt will arise in us. So we're opening to trusting this Dharma. We're letting doubt sort of, we're not rejecting doubt, but we're maybe suspending doubt temporarily in order to really explore a new way of looking. And that upon meeting this true Dharma, we shall, as we chanted it, renounce worldly affairs and maintain the Buddha Dharma. It's maybe a kind of heavy-duty way of saying, just let go of all our usual concerns of the rest of our life in Sesshin. Such an opportunity. Like, we all have all our stuff to come back to afterwards, right? And even if we're just here for a little bit, while we're here, we can say, when we enter the door of the Zendo for Sesshin, this is hard to do, right? But we can say, let's practice, like checking our worldly concerns at the door. You know, like there's like a check your coat at the door, right? Like you give it to the
concern rack.
What's that?
The concern rack.
Like your shoes, right? Yeah. You can use the shoe rack this week for a concern rack. And you could say when you take off your shoes, you can also like kind of take off your concerns about the before and after life outside the Zen, and you can put them on your shoes so you won't lose them. And you can pick them up again after. And that way, then we have the chance to slide under this, because it takes some, if we're really getting into like running through all the list of concerns in Sesshin, which is a popular Sesshin activity. I like to do it sometimes myself. But then it's really, you know, then meanwhile, this not two reality is like kind of like banging on our door and saying, hey, what about me? And we say, wait a second, I got to work through the rest of my life. And so it's banging, but its hands are very, very small and almost like transparent. So the knock, with, you know, it's banging as loud as it can, the not-to reality. But our, like, you know, worldly concerns are so much louder that it's hard to hear. So if we check them at the door, then we're just like, we're here, and of course our stuff comes up, our thoughts, but we can just gently, without rejecting, gently just, okay, I'm just here. This is an opportunity to enjoy deeper reality. You know what I mean? And it's hard. Our concerns like to dominate the scene. So really we could, if we remember, we could even remember literally like taking the shoes off as a reminder. Like I'm about to go in the Zendo with all my kids. Oh, wait a second. Go back out again and like kind of pull them off and put them on the shoes. Okay, now I'm here. And then we can start to explore. The thing is about all these concerns is they're all about the past and the future, pretty much. So if we put them aside, then we still have concerns in the present, like maybe like the pain in my body. That's okay. That's, I think, more okay to work with this. Because if it's happening right now. But then we can start to explore the right now experience. Pain in the body. Maybe an aching heart. But not based on all stories of past and future, but just the physical feeling. And we can start to see now the aching heart, the tingling in the knees. Are these something other than the knowing of an aching heart and a tingling knee? Yeah? Any questions about this so far? So so you got the, yes.
Why, so we talked about sensations like as an object we can investigate to better understand that there's no difference between the sensation and knowing and merely knowing it.
Very nice summary, beautifully put. Yes.
But why? Why can't we do that with the past, these stories that come up?
Ah, yep, yeah. Yeah, good question.
Yeah.
I think actually we can, you know, theoretically, we can do with any experience, and a physical sensation is an experience, and a story of the past is also an experience. So yes, we can. I just think it's much more difficult to do with it. With a complex conceptual story, because almost like if we're thinking of a sort of a narrative story, that means that we're like pretty involved in the story. We're almost like imagining it's happening. So almost to step back and realize that, oh, this story that I'm imagining is just the knowing of the story. If we do that in a moment, it's almost like the narrative starts to disintegrate. So we can try it. I think it's nice to warm up to how it works with the more direct things like the body and the sounds and the physical experiences. But you're right. We could do it with anything. It's more like why for meditation objects, we generally have things like the breath and the body posture. We usually don't say, take your fantasy of next year's vacation as a meditation object. Usually traditionally, you could do it, but it's usually not recommended just because it's so conceptual. Yes.
How frightening it is to go into the dark and let go of that conception.
Mm-hmm.
I just had that one time with food and an Oreoke meal in Tassajara. I was enjoying something I was eating, and then my attachment to it disappeared, and it was just sensation, and it wasn't something I loved anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It was just something that didn't have a name.
Yes.
And it was really startling. You know, like, so then I wasn't enjoying it as much.
Ah.
It was this real window into like, gosh, oh God, it is made up, you know.
That's a beautiful story.
It was very well seasoned. But it just
yeah.
It was so direct. disappear.
Yeah. So I think that's very much what we're talking about, mm-hmm. is that kind of thing. And like you say, at first it may seem frightening because almost like there's, we have a kind of like a sentimentality around our love of pinto beans. So it's like, I actually feel like I'm a pretty sentimental guy, you know, I like to cry in sad movies and love stories and so on, right? But we love, you know, there's something beautiful about sentimentality actually, right? And we almost feel like, if we really let go of that and that we're just tasting and we don't love or hate it, it's almost like we feel like our part of our humanity might be lost, right? It's like, well, that sounds kind of like bland, dry life if everything's sort of the same. I think maybe at first we get a little glimpse of it and it feels that way, and that and then that very fear. No, I'd rather go back to actually loving pinto beans or hating them. But I think the more we open to it, the more we see that actually it's not bland and dry and lifeless. It's actually more vibrant and alive, even though it's not really knowing what's going on.
I think that actually was my experience. It was something very vibrant, but then later.
Yeah, maybe that's the voice, the habitual voice of like, let me just love the pinto beans, okay? I don't need to like be eating the suchness of pinto beans. And I think, yeah, it's hard to say what that vibrancy beyond love and hate and habitual reactions is, but we just have to fearlessly open to it and try it out and see if it's like, actually, it's totally alive. And I think the more we can open to that, then the more we see that this more like this not one, not two part, that it doesn't mean that we like never enjoy pinto beans. It means we're enjoying them at the same time. We know that the enjoyment of them is actually just the knowing of the enjoyment, you could say. So nothing is really eliminated or changed. It's more like it's this wider, more all-inclusive. And of course, the implications are that the things that we actually hate and are suffering, that part becomes much more manageable and lovable, maybe even. This is all about joy and peace. Yes?
And doesn't that go back to what we talked about earlier? The experience of whatever we're eating and that experience compared to the thought of or the knowledge of.
Yeah.
Which is directly in that teaching.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also then we might have this, we might say, I'm really looking forward to the pinto bean lunch. Or something, because we saw it on the menu, and then it ends up being bananas or something, and we're like, because of this thinking idea that we're like, we really wanted the pinto beans, then the bananas come, and we miss the direct experience of the bananas. Maybe we actually love bananas too, but we were just really counting on pinto beans, and now we're like, it's hard to enjoy the bananas if we're just really into the like and dislike thing. So if we're into just the momentary knowing of this experience, we're like, wow, bananas, they don't even compare to pinto beans, because there are no pinto beans in the whole universe. There's only this banana on the tongue right now. That's the kind of directness beyond comparison. Yeah. Yes.
So you started this discourse on knowing and divided knowing
because
of this story, would we say that the 12th ancestor, the 11th ancestor is saying, when you give up divided knowing, it's not giving up knowing.
That's right. That's right. And Keizan, I think we'll get into that a little bit, but I think that this most knowing all through the story is talking about the divided knowing. Right? So, I want to know Buddha. And I think he maybe was thinking, even if he maybe even has heard those kind of teachings, but I really want to know awakening. Still, even if you can't get it, but I really want to know it. This feeling of like, even just a little bit of divided knowing. I want to know Buddha as an experience that I can have. That's divided knowing. I want to know Buddha as a known experience that the experiencer can have. Don't you want to know Buddha that way? But actually we could say Buddha isn't an experience, but we maybe could say Buddha is the experiencing, the ever-present experiencing of pinto beans, bananas, and tingling knees. Buddha is something that doesn't come and go, so it must be ever-present. And Buddha could be this knowing, undivided knowing.
Actually, you can apply that to putting your shoes on the rack or putting your life up there. Mm-hmm. It sounded like, get over there because I'm going to be involved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's useful.
Hmm.
It's not that you're not letting go of your everyday concerns, but I think it's more useful if you just bow to them and empty yourself. Go here, and you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah,
when you're going to pick up those shoes.
Yeah.
Or you're going to pick them up in a different way and wear them in a different way.
Yeah, and we don't know if we put our concerns on the shoe rack as soon as we sit down, and they're like, they crawl out from behind our back and like, you thought you put me on the shoe rack. Which they usually do, right?
Yeah, but there is a connection between your putting them on the shoe rack and emptying yourself.
By putting on the shoe rack, I didn't mean to imply that like, you put them on the shoe rack and you walk in the door and you're just like, there's no more thoughts happening for 40 minutes. Of course, that's not even realistic. I was thinking that image more like the really gross kind of obsessing about like, I'm going to actually plant, I got to work some stuff out in my life. I'm going to use the next period of Zazen to do it from top to bottom. I'm making a list in my head of the 10 steps, how I'm going to like work through my life. That kind of thing, you know, we can put on the shoe rack. But of course, stuff will keep coming up. So I meant it more the image of the really kind of like grosser, you know, major obsessions that we might be able to leave, meaning like just having the intention. Putting them on the shoe rack basically just means I have the intention to be really present with whatever comes up. And then maybe they do crawl out from behind our back in the Zendo and say, here I am again. And like, okay, but now instead of working you out, you story of my life, now I'm going to actually just study you. So yeah, we don't reject it.
We don't reject it.
Yeah, of course. Yes, right. Right, yes. Yeah, it's more the relation. What we say is maybe the so-called worldly concerns we're leaving is the intention to try to work things out. We're leaving that outside. But we can let all this stuff in now. But now I'm not trying to work this story out. Now I'm trying to just study the story or see what it is, which is not rejecting it. So, you want to know the Buddha, but that which does not know in this divided way is Buddha. And then Keizan says, the one who does not know points to Ashvaghosha himself and to all of us. Our true nature is the one who doesn't know. Whether it's known or not, it has no particular way to be or other appearance. Now we're talking about Kazan's going into this one who doesn't know. What is this one who doesn't know? From past to present, it is just thus. Sometimes it bears the 32 marks and possesses 80 minor marks. Or it bears 3 heads and 8 arms, which is a description of the Asura realm, the fighting titans. It's one of the 6 realms of samsara. So this is a poetic way of saying, sometimes it, this one that doesn't know, has 32 marks of a Buddha. Sometimes it has 3 heads and 8 arms of a fighting spirit of samsara. Or it's subject to the signs of decay and forms of suffering of the Deva realm. Sometimes it's covered with horns and hair. That's the animal realm. Or sometimes it wears iron shackles and chains. That's the hell realm. So this one who doesn't know can take all these forms of the 6 realms of samsara, or the 80 marks and 32 marks of a Buddha. But whatever form it takes, it is always in the world, this world, taking care and being the way it appears, coming and going within the mind of oneself. Ji Xin. This one not knowing is coming and going within our own mind, putting on different faces. This one who doesn't know. That actually the one who doesn't know doesn't come and go, but it appears to be always coming and going and putting on the different faces of animals and humans and Buddhas and hell beings. And dividing it, appearing in this divided form of knower and known. The not knowing one can appear in the form of a knower and a known. It's free to do that if it wants to. It seems like it does want to. Here I am, and there are you. We dedicate the merit of our exploring the teachings of the Zen ancestors to those very Zen ancestors. May their wisdom and compassion shine on us today and throughout space and time. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.